We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today is an episode of the Weekly Docket where we recap the headlines in true crime for the week. Before we get started with all these stories today, I want to make a note about our last episode, which was a Mama Minute episode. These episodes are not related to true crime. This is more of like a trending topic type of episode to kind of balance out the heaviness of true crime. And so I really enjoy doing these episodes. And if you ever have a story that you would like for me to cover, or if you want to send me your own story that you want to vent on the airwaves, you know, you can go to mamamystery.com and send me a message through my website. If you want me to know who you are going to have to tell me, otherwise it will be anonymous. But I thought it might be fun. Okay, so let me actually back up a little bit. This morning I went to breakfast with one of my best friends, Emily. Her mom listens to this podcast, but Emily does not. She's just not into true crime, which I totally forgive her for. But we had a great conversation. We laughed constantly. I could have sat there and talked to her for hours, honestly. But we were talking about icks that our spouses give us. We love our spouses, obviously. I love my husband. She loves her husband. But she had some of the funniest stories about things that ick her out about her husband. And I thought it would be funny to maybe include a segment. If you have an ick that you really just want to get off your chest and just vent about, you can go to mamamystery.com and send me a message and I'll read it on the next Mama Minute episode next week. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I thought it would be kind of funny and maybe therapeutic, you know, to get some things off your chest that just really bug you. And it's not like you're going to divorce your spouse over these icks, but it's like, come on, can you just not? Like last night, I'll just be honest with you guys. Last night, Austin and I were having a conversation and he had white strips in his mouth. He was whitening his teeth and he kept talking to me and he had this like lisp because he was talking with these white strips. And finally, I just had to shut it off and be like, listen, I love you, but you need to go brush your teeth and get that crap off your lip. I can't listen to it anymore or I'm going to lose my mind. It was really late. It was at the end of the day and I was just spent. And I was like, I cannot listen to you talk like this. Like, I just can't. And that was an ick for me. So, you know, that's just one example. I love you, Austin. He's not even going to know that I said this. Someone's going to come up to him in public and say, you've been whitening those teeth. And I can't wait for that moment. All right. Without further ado, we've got a lot of stories to cover. So I'm going to shift gears into more serious true crime, Kelly. Let's dive in. This first story is out of Dakota County, Minnesota, and the key names to know up front are Jack Joseph Ball and his sister, Bethany Ann Israel. Jack is 24 and from Lakeville, and Bethany was 30 years old, lived in Bloomington, and the medical examiner determined that she was between 17 and 18 weeks pregnant when she was killed. Now, here is what happened. According to the Dakota County Attorney's Office, everything unfolded on Thursday, May 23rd of 2024. Bethany had plans to have dinner with Jack at a residence in Lakeville earlier that evening. When she did not return home, family members started getting pretty worried, so their mom drove out to the Lakeville residence and said that she saw Jack just tear out of the house. She literally said, quote, tear out of the house, end quote. When she went inside, she reported seeing a significant amount of blood and called the authorities. The Lakeville Police Department responded at around 11 p.m. and reported finding bloody knives and dismembered body parts that were believed to be Bethany's. And then things took an even darker turn. While police were looking for Jack, they got a 911 call from a Rosemount resident who said that their home security camera captured a man placing what appeared to be a body part on their front step. Officers responded, they searched the area, and they found Jack in the backyard of a neighboring home where he was taken into custody. Authorities said that he had a neck injury that appeared to be self-inflicted, and he was taken to a local hospital where he ultimately survived. I don't understand why these cowardly men can be so brutal. It makes me think of Bianca Devins and her case, where her attacker brutally killed her and then, you know, attempted to give himself a self-inflicted wound, but it was actually just superficial because these cowards have plenty of courage to, you know, take out their rage on an innocent woman and yet barely have the gall to give themselves a paper cut. But anyway, the Dakota County Attorney's Office later said that the cause of her death was complex homicidal violence. So multiple things could have caused her death. It was a very violent attack. A few days later, on May 28th of 2024, prosecutors announced that Jack had been charged in connection with Bethany's death and the death of her unborn child. He allegedly told police when he was arrested that he did it because she was, quote, no longer innocent, end quote. Then on January 9th of 2025, a Dakota County grand jury indicted him on multiple counts, including premeditated first-degree murder charges. So fast forward to last week, which was January 21st of 2026, the Dakota County Attorney's Office announced that Jack had pleaded guilty to premeditated first-degree murder and premeditated first-degree murder of an unborn child. Now, even with the guilty plea, prosecutors say Jack has asserted a defense of mental illness. And Minnesota law allows that issue to be litigated separately, whether a mental illness made him unable to understand what he was doing or that it was wrong at the time. Minnesota law states that a person is not criminally responsible if a mental illness made the person unable to understand what they were doing or know that it was wrong at the time the offense was committed. So if he is convicted at that trial, he faces a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment. And this part kind of confused me, so I looked into it because I wondered, why does he still have to stand trial if he pleaded guilty? And here is what I learned. Minnesota does not use the phrase guilty by reason of insanity like some states. So the question for the court is this: did the defendant, because of mental illness or cognitive impairment, lack substantial capacity to understand the nature of the act or that it was wrong at the time it occurred? So it's not a trial about whether or not he did it. We know he did. That has been established. This is actually a bench trial, meaning there's no jury. This is just going to go in front of a judge, and the judge, him or herself, will decide the outcome. So the court will hear psych evaluations from state-appointed experts and defense experts. There will be medical records, evidence of behavior before, during, and after the crime. So there are three realistic outcomes in this situation. The first most likely outcome is that the mental illness defense is rejected, because it often is in this state. And if so, the conviction will stand and he will have a mandatory life sentence in prison, not a state hospital. The second possible outcome is if the mental illness defense is accepted, he is found not guilty by reason of mental illness. At that point, he would be committed to a secure state psychiatric hospital, and he could be held there indefinitely, often for life. So think Andrea Yates, for example. The third possibility is that the court could find mental illness existed, but not enough to excuse criminal responsibility. So in this case, the conviction would still stand, and mental illness may affect his placement or treatment, but not the actual sentence itself. As of right now, he remains in custody at the Dakota County Jail. Now, the next story is kind of a high-profile one and really surreal. Austin actually brought this one up to me. So the defendant in this case is Ryan Wedding, a former Canadian Olympic snowboarder who competed in the 2002 Winter Olympics. He is now at the center of a massive federal criminal case involving drug trafficking, organized crime, and murder conspiracy. So let's back up. Who is Ryan Wedding? He is now 43 years old, and before becoming a drug lord, he was known for representing Canada as a snowboarder in the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics. He competed in the men's parallel giant slalom event. He did not medal, but he qualified for the Olympics, which in itself places him among the greatest snowboarders in the country at that time. After his Olympic career ended, prosecutors say his life took a very different turn. He moved back to Vancouver and developed an interest in bodybuilding and started working as a bouncer. He was also attending Simon Fraser University, but dropped out 2 years in and began dabbling in real estate. to apparently finance his real estate venture, he started a marijuana farm at an 8,000 plant warehouse on a suburban property called 18 Carat Farms, located in British Columbia. But in 2006, the RCMP, which is essentially the police force in Canada, raided that farm. They found a shotgun, ammunition, and $10 million worth of cannabis. However, Ryan was not at the farm at that time, and apparently there was not enough evidence to charge him with anything. So from there, he chose to expand his operation by joining teams with Ukrainian and Russian cocaine smugglers. Every time this guy hits a roadblock or any kind of consequence, he literally doubles down and just ups his game. So in 2010, he was actually convicted of trying to buy cocaine from a U.S. government agent in 2008, and he spent 4 years in prison before he was ultimately released in 2011. After his stint in prison, according to federal authorities, Ryan became deeply involved in international drug trafficking, specifically large-scale cocaine distribution. Multiple federal agencies came together to form an operation called Operation Giant Slalom, obviously after Ryan Wedding's stint in the Olympics. And Ryan was one of 16 people to be charged in this operation. So Ryan Wedding himself is accused of having carried out the murder of a married couple, 57-year-old Jagtar Sidhu and 55-year-old Harbjan Sidhu, and Mohammed Zafar, who was 39 years old. It's also believed that Ryan Wedding ordered those murders alongside Andrew Clark, who was also charged with the murder of Randy Fader, who was only 29 years old. And we'll kind of get to those details in just a second. But ultimately, this is not a low-level operation. Prosecutors describe him as someone who allegedly worked at a leadership level. He coordinated shipments, logistics, and enforcement. He operated out of Mexico and became a high-ranking member of the Sinaloa Cartel, which is Mexico's largest drug cartel, where he was known as El Jefe, which in Spanish, that means the boss. On March 6th of 2025, he was added to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. In January of 2026, he was captured in Mexico City, and from there, Ryan was formally charged with 17 federal felony counts in the United States. Those charges include conspiracy to distribute cocaine, conspiracy to import controlled substances, money laundering, and conspiracy to commit murder. Federal prosecutors allege that Ryan Wedding was not just moving drugs, but was also involved in planning or authorizing violence tied to the drug operation, including these murder-for-hire plots that were connected to essentially protecting the enterprise. The U.S. Department of Treasury and Justice Department have taken the unusual step of sanctioning people that they say played a major role in supporting him while he was a fugitive, including members of his inner circle, people trusted with money laundering, and even women who were close to him. So according to those sanctions and law enforcement statements, his wife, Miriam Andrea Castillo Moreno, was at one point accused by officials of helping launder drug proceeds and assist with violent acts tied to the operation, although she was later removed from the sanctions list after questions about evidence. He and Miriam eventually divorced, and then he got a Colombian girlfriend named Daniela Alejandra Acuña Macias. And this person is still on the sanctions list and is accused of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars from him, allegedly knowing that it came from drug trafficking. Federal prosecutors also named an alleged madam, Carmen Yelenet Valoyes Flores, tying her to money laundering and conspiracy to commit murder linked to Ryan Wedding's whole network. And then another woman, Yulieth Catherine Tejada, was charged with helping Ryan's organization track down a cooperating informant so that that informant could be killed. So I guess she kind of like lured this informant, who I believe is Ryan Fader, who I mentioned earlier. So I think that's how they're all tied together. But she essentially lured this guy under the guise that she was like a sex worker, I guess. So At the time, charges were unsealed. Ryan Wedding had already been on the run for several months, and law enforcement says that he moved between locations, allegedly using false identities, relying on associates to essentially avoid capture. His case gained even more attention because of his Olympic past, which made him immediately recognizable once his name was actually released. He tried disguising himself with a mustache, you guys, like try a little harder, but Wedding was eventually arrested and taken into custody, and once in court, he pleaded not guilty to all of the charges. So that means that this case is heading toward a full federal trial unless a plea agreement is reached before then, and prosecutors have made it very clear that they intend to pursue the case aggressively, pointing to what they describe as extensive surveillance, financial records, and cooperating witnesses. So as of now, he remains in custody. No trial date has been finalized. And if convicted on all counts, he faces decades in federal prison, potentially life, depending on how sentencing enhancements apply. So this is still a very active and developing case, and prosecutors say that more details are expected to come out as pretrial motions continue to move forward. But it sounds like if they don't lock this guy up, he's just going to keep upping the ante every time he gets out, and I would hate to see what else he is capable of. So I'll keep an eye on this case and update you in future weekly dockets. This next case is out of Florida, and it goes all the way back to 1998, but it's back in court right now because of changes in how the death penalty sentences are handled in the state. So the defendant is Harold Brady, who was sentenced to death more than two decades ago for the kidnapping and murder of a five-year-old girl, a crime that prosecutors say ended with her being left to die in the Florida Everglades. So the crime happened in June of 1998. The victim was Nicole Lynn Kimmel, who was just 5 years old. According to court records, Nicole was abducted from outside of a convenience store in Davie, Florida, while her mother was briefly inside. Prosecutors say Brady took Nicole from the area without her mom's knowledge and drove her away. Authorities say he then drove Nicole west and abandoned her in the Everglades, leaving her there alone in a remote, swampy area known for extreme heat, standing water, and wildlife. Nicole's body was later found, and investigators determined she had drowned. But prosecutors have always emphasized that her death was the result of being intentionally left in an environment where survival was impossible for a child. Brady was arrested, charged, and ultimately convicted of first-degree murder and kidnapping. In 2000, a jury recommended the death penalty, and Brady was formally sentenced to death. At the time, Florida law did not require a unanimous jury to impose a death sentence. A majority recommendation was enough, and he has remained on Florida death row ever since. So why is this case back in the court now? Well, this resentencing has nothing to do with new evidence or any kind of doubts of guilt. Instead, it stems from major changes in death penalty law. In the years since Brady's original sentencing, both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Florida Supreme Court ruled that Florida's death penalty process was unconstitutional because it allowed judges to impose death sentences without a unanimous jury finding on aggravating factors. So because Brady was sentenced under the old system, he is now legally entitled to a new sentencing phase. So this is not a new trial. His conviction still stands, and the jury will not have to reconsider any kind of guilt. The facts of the crime are not being relitigated. The only question now is the punishment. So prosecutors are again seeking the death penalty, while the defense is asking for life in prison without the possibility of parole. During this resentencing phase, jurors will hear and consider details of the crime, victim impact testimony, aggravating factors presented by prosecutors, and any kind of mitigating factors presented by the defense, including his background, mental health, and behavior in prison. So for Harold Brady or Brady to receive the death penalty, the jury must meet two separate thresholds. First, they must unanimously agree on at least one aggravating factor, meaning all jurors must agree that there is something about the crime that legally makes it death eligible. If and only if the jury unanimously finds an aggravating factor, then they vote on punishment, and at least eight jurors must vote in favor of the death penalty to recommend the death penalty. So a vote of 7-5 or lower will automatically result in life without parole. In Florida, kidnapping is considered to be an aggravating factor when it is committed in the commission of another violent crime like murder. So we should know soon what his fate will be. If it were up to me, I would throw his ass out into the Everglades like Naked and Afraid and say good luck and good riddance. You shouldn't get to do that to a 5-year-old child and then spend the rest of your life in any type of comfort, even if that comfort is a prison. That's just my opinion. And on that note, let's take a quick break. I'm going to grab some water. Thank the sponsors of today's episode and be right back. Getting dressed should not be that hard. And yet somehow, whenever I'm like trying to dress up to go on a date or do something fun with Austin, I'm usually standing in front of a full closet thinking, I have nothing to wear. And that is why I love Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy with a clothing rental membership that builds a wardrobe just for you with high quality, unique brands that actually make sense for your life. You take a quick 5-minute style quiz, pick items from your personalized closet, and they show up at your door in as little as 2 days. When you're ready for something new, you just swap them out and that's it. I've been using Armoire because my body, my lifestyle, and just my personal style have all changed, and buying new clothes every time just isn't feeling realistic. One of my favorite pieces I've rented was actually this white and blue dress that Austin and I went to a Teddy Swims concert. I wore the dress. I actually posted a video of us dancing at the concert and it went kind of viral. And I had so many people asking me where I got this dress, and I rented it from Armoire. And I'll also be honest, I've always felt guilty about how many things in my closet I've only worn once, if at all. Some things still have a tag on them, but Armoire completely changed that for me. I get to stay on trend, wear beautiful designer pieces, and then there's also like loungewear that I love too. I had this really beautiful floral Kate Spade wind jacket, like wind blazer. It was so cute. I wore it on vacation, got lots of compliments, and then when I didn't feel like wearing it anymore, you just send it back. It's so easy. Another huge bonus, Armoire is women-founded and women-led. They even spotlight women-owned designers, which makes me feel good about where my money is going. So if you're struggling to define your style right now, or maybe your body is changing because of fitness or pregnancy or just life, Armoire is such a good solution. You can size up, size down, try new silhouettes, and swap whenever you need to. There's no commitment, no pressure, just clothes that fit you where you are. And somehow it's all designer without the designer price tag. Instead of spending hundreds on one dress that I might wear one time, I kind of get this rotating closet of high-end pieces for a fraction of the cost. Fashion math finally makes sense. It's not girl math, it's fashion math. One feature I have to mention is quarterly rentals, because Armoire is the only rental company that lets you keep favorite pieces for an entire season for just $10 a month. So if you find something you truly love, you don't have to give it back right away. And if you decide to keep it, then that fee ends up going towards the final purchase. You get to decide what stays for a month, a season, or forever. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama, MAMA, to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today and thank me tomorrow. Every January, I tell myself the same thing. This is the year I'm going to feel better, more energy, clearer focus, just less dragging myself through every day. And I'll be honest, I usually start the year doing everything right, or at least I think I am. Like, I'm sleeping, I'm eating better, I'm moving my body, and somehow I still feel exhausted and foggy and irritable over things that normally should not get to me, like even just my kids being kids. Well, for a long time, I just assumed that that was stress or burnout or just life in general. And what I didn't realize is that low iron can show up really quietly. Things like persistent fatigue, brain fog, headaches that don't go fully away, brittle nails, hair breakage, stuff that's easy to brush off or normalize. These are all symptoms that I was dealing with because I was suffering from low iron. And here's the thing, iron deficiency can exist even before anemia actually develops. So you can feel off long before anything looks serious or shows up like on a blood panel. So that is why I started looking into Siderol from PharmaNutra. Siderol is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology. So basically the iron is protected so your body can absorb it more efficiently, about 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And without the common stomach issues that people associate with iron supplements like nausea or constipation. It's made with just 2 main ingredients. There's 30 milligrams of sucrosomial iron and vitamin C, and it's a simple once-a-day capsule that you can take anytime with or without food. So what stood out to me is that it's backed by over 20 years of research and more than 150 clinical studies, and it's already trusted by over 2 million people worldwide. So if you're starting the year feeling kind of tired or foggy despite having these otherwise good habits, you're not alone, and this might be the support that your body needs. So do yourself a favor and head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com with the promo code MAMA. Feeling off doesn't always mean something's wrong. Sometimes it just means something is missing. So check it out today.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Now, this next one comes out of Australia, and it's really unsettling because of how transactional it all was, and to think that something like this actually exists. I know we hear about this kind of thing like in movies. I don't know. It just always seems like it's too unbelievable to be true. So according to New South Wales Police Force, investigators uncovered organized crime networks openly advertising violent crimes for hire, complete with pricing lists inside of these encrypted messaging platforms, most notably Telegram. And police say that this was not like a vague criminal chatter. It was actually structured, it was organized, and it was like a murder menu. So during an ongoing investigation into organized crime, NSW police gained access to a private encrypted chat group, or groups, plural, where violence was allegedly being marketed like a service. So police say the groups contained what they described as menus, essentially a list of violent crimes that were available for hire. And according to those investigators, the services included things like assaults and bashings, kidnappings, arson, extortion, and in some cases, murder. Each act allegedly came with a set price, with costs increasing depending on the severity of violence, the level of risk involved, and how quickly the crime needed to be carried out. Authorities say people inside the chat groups were not speaking in code. They were literally asking for quotes, negotiating terms, requesting timelines, and in some cases, asking for proof once a job was completed. Investigators say the tone of the conversations suggested that the people offering these services believed they were operating safely behind encryption, essentially insulated from any kind of detection. And according to investigators, you didn't need deep underworld connections to hire violence. You just needed access to the right chat group and, I guess, enough money. NSW police say the investigation has already led to multiple arrests, with those suspects facing charges related to participation in criminal groups, conspiracy to commit serious indictable offenses, and using encrypted communication to facilitate violent crime. Police have not released all identities tied to the case, citing the scope of the investigation and the likelihood of additional arrests. So obviously they're not going to say who's who, you know, and give them a chance to run. But authorities are using this case to highlight how technology has changed the way that violent crime is organized and committed. Police say encrypted platforms are increasingly being used not to just communicate, but to coordinate this type of activity, which is really scary. But on the flip side, I guess it's kind of a relief that we now learn that encryption does not exactly equal immunity, and that these platforms, you know, are now a major focus in organized crime investigations going forward. So you can try to hide, but they'll find you. All right, the next case is especially fascinating for anyone who follows true crime. The person at the center of this is Mary Carol McDonnell. She is a 73-year-old former TV executive who once ran a production company that specialized in true crime programming. She is now listed on the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Most Wanted list, not for a violent offense, but for a massive federal fraud case. So before the charges surfaced, Mary was the CEO of Bellum Entertainment Group, a production and distribution company that was based in Burbank, California. She produced and distributed multiple true crime TV series that aired on cable networks and in syndication, including It Takes a Killer, I Married a Murderer, Corrupt Crimes, and Bizarre Murders. Her company worked squarely within the true crime space, which is what makes this case so crazy, that she was literally making these TV shows while committing crimes of her own. Now, according to federal prosecutors, the alleged crimes took place between July of 2017 and May of 2018. And during that time, authorities say that she carried out a scheme in which she falsely claimed to be a wealthy heiress tied to the McDonnell Douglas aircraft manufacturing family. Investigators say that claim was completely fabricated and that she had no connection to that family or to the massive trust funds that she claimed to control. Federal court records allege that Mary McDonnell used this false identity to obtain large loans from financial institutions, primarily Bank of California. And prosecutors say she submitted fraudulent documents and made repeated misrepresentations about her personal wealth to convince lenders that she had access to these enormous financial resources. So according to the FBI, she allegedly obtained approximately $14.7 million from Bank of California alone, with total attempted or actual losses across multiple institutions reaching nearly $30 million. In December of 2018, a federal grand jury in the Central District of California indicted McDonnell on charges including bank fraud and aggravated identity theft, and a federal arrest warrant was issued. But McDonnell was never taken into custody because she fled the U.S. and has remained outside of the country ever since. The FBI believes that she may be living in Dubai, though her exact location has not been confirmed. Because of the size of the alleged fraud, the outstanding federal warrant, and her ability to evade arrest for years, the FBI ultimately added her to its Most Wanted list, which is a designation that is not limited to violent offenders, but reserved for fugitives whose capture is considered to be a priority. As of now, Mary McDonnell remains at large, and the FBI continues to ask for public tips regarding her whereabouts. I don't know about you, but I just picture this woman like sipping Mai Tais next to a fabulous pool out in Dubai, and like she's 73. She's probably like, I'm just, you know, senioritis. I'm living out the rest of my days in this beautiful country with tons of money, and she's just swimming in money. I certainly hope she's caught, because consequences matter and choices have, you know, consequences. But I just find it all ironic that she was this TV producer producing these true crime shows while committing true crime herself. So anyway, this next case that I'm bringing you unfolded across central Minnesota and set off a massive search that drew hundreds of volunteers and multiple law enforcement agencies. But good news is it has a happy ending. So it started on Wednesday, January 21st, in the city of Zimmerman, which is about 40 miles northwest of Minneapolis. A 7-year-old girl named Brinley, I'm gonna preserve her last name just to for her safety, but Brinley was reportedly abducted shortly after she got off her school bus in the late afternoon. Family members initially couldn't locate her, and a call went out to authorities. So Sherburne County Dispatch received the call at about 6:30 p.m., and within hours, the situation escalated with local, state, and federal agencies joining in, along with tons of volunteers from the community. At times, more than 200 law enforcement personnel and 700 community volunteers were involved in the search in frigid temperatures, which is just a testament to how seriously everyone took this disappearance. At first, there was confusion about her whereabouts because she should have been home by around 4 p.m., but miscommunication among family members about her drop-off point delayed the initial search. So once authorities were notified, they quickly determined that the circumstances pointed to a stranger abduction rather than a misunderstanding. As the evening wore on, investigators developed a suspect description and connected a white Dodge Ram pickup truck to the case. An integrated public alert and warning system message, similar to an Amber Alert, was sent out to Sherburne County residents to help locate the vehicle and the missing girl. Shortly before 1 a.m. on Thursday, January 22nd, officers in the Albert Lee area, about 140 miles south of Zimmerman, spotted the pickup truck and pulled it over. And inside the vehicle was Brinley. She was found safe. She was taken to a local hospital for evaluation, and she was later reunited with her family. Praise God. The man driving the pickup, Joseph Andrew Bragg, who was 28 years old, was taken into custody without incident. And at the time, authorities said Bragg had no permanent address and no significant criminal history, according to officials involved in the case. Once in custody, he was booked into the Freeborn County Jail and later formally charged in Sherburne County District Court with felony kidnapping and first-degree criminal sexual conduct in connection with the incident. Obviously, I don't know what exactly that, like, the details are surrounding that, and I wouldn't share them if I did, but Sherburne County Sheriff's Office Commander Ben Zawaki said, and multiple officials with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension said that the investigation is ongoing, including inquiries into what they described as a possible social media tie between the suspect and the victim, though authorities have not released details about what that means or how it may have factored into the abduction. So the community's response was a major part of this story, with hundreds of people turning out in freezing temperatures to help search for this little girl, and the vigilance of multiple people in the area and surrounding areas to keep an eye out for that truck is ultimately what brought her home alive. So as of now, Brinley has been reunited with her family. She's being evaluated by medical staff. Joseph Andrew Bragg remains in custody on kidnapping and sexual conduct charges. And the investigation continues, with law enforcement expected to reveal more details as the case moves forward. But it's just rare that we hear about cases like this where someone is abducted but is found alive. I really hate that she even had to go through any of this. And I cringe at the thought of any kind of criminal sexual conduct charges that are going to be brought against him. And man, my heart goes out to her and her family, and I just hope that she's able to recover from this. The next story comes out of Lafayette, Indiana, and involves an attack on a sitting judge and his wife that authorities say was part of a concerted effort to derail an unrelated criminal trial. On Sunday, January 18th, Stephen P. Meyer, a judge on the Tippecanoe Superior Court II in Tippecanoe County, Indiana, and his wife, Kimberly Meyer, were both shot at their home in Lafayette. Surveillance footage and court documents show a man in disguise approached their front door just after 2 p.m., knocked, and then fired multiple shots through the closed door while the couple was inside. Stephen Meyer was struck in the arm, and Kimberly Meyer was hit in the hip. Both were transported to a hospital in stable condition. Investigators allege that the shooting was a targeted attack meant to thwart a separate criminal prosecution that was about to go to trial. Court records show that one of the people charged in the shooting, Thomas Moss, was scheduled to stand trial on Tuesday, January 20th, before Judge Meyer in a case involving charges from 2024, including unlawful possession of a firearm by a violent felon, shooting into a building, and domestic battery with a deadly weapon. So it sounds like he's done this before. Prosecutors say Judge Meyer had recently denied Moss's request to further postpone that trial. So this was obviously not random. After an extensive multi-agency investigation, law enforcement arrested five people in connection with the shooting. Police identified the suspects as Raylan Ferguson, Thomas Moss, Blake Smith, Amanda Millsap, and Zenaida Greer. According to the probable cause affidavits and reports from the Lafayette Police Department, Raylan Ferguson is 38 of Lexington, Kentucky, and this person is accused of being the person who actually fired the shots through the Meyer residence's front door. Prosecutors say DNA on a mask left near the scene matched Raylan's profile. Thomas Moss, who was 43 of Lafayette, Indiana, is accused of helping plan and orchestrate the attack. Prosecutors say Moss has documented ties to a motorcycle club identified as the Phantom Motorcycle Club and to the Vice Lords gang organization, and that the shooting was designed to disrupt the court case that is against him. Blake Smith, who is only 32 of Lafayette, is accused of multiple charges, including attempting to assist with the shooting and providing weapons. Prosecutors allege he purchased a shotgun that was allegedly used. Amanda Millsap is 45 of Lafayette and is accused of attempting to bribe a witness in Moss's trial so that she wouldn't testify, and of obstruction of justice. And Zenaida Greer, who is 61 of Lexington, Kentucky, is accused of assisting a criminal and obstruction of justice in connection with the attack. Court filings also describe a suspicious incident just days before the shooting when someone approached Judge Meyer's home claiming to be a food delivery person. Surveillance footage captured that man knocking on the door using the same distinct cadence later seen in the video that was shortly before the shooting. Meyer did not open the door that time either. Investigators also reported that a potential witness in Moss's trial later told police that about 8 days before the shooting, someone wearing a mask knocked on her Pennsylvania home and then left, reinforcing a pattern of troubling contact that has been tied to this case. So as of now, the three men, Ferguson, Moss, and Smith, face multiple felony charges, including attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, aggravated battery, and related enhancements. Millsap faces charges related to bribery and obstruction of justice, and Zenaida Greer is charged with assisting a criminal and obstruction. All five suspects are in custody, and prosecutors have requested some pretty high bond amounts, understandably so. The case has been transferred to another judge as proceedings move forward. Now, this last story I'm bringing you has been taking social media by storm, and it takes us to Billings, Montana. It happened at Billings Senior High School during a time when the building still had a lot going on. School was out of session, but I believe there was still some organized activities happening at the school. There was a wrestling meet and maybe some other clubs happening. So there were still a lot of people at the school despite, you know, the school being out for the day. But according to Billings Public Schools Superintendent Erwin Garcia, the incident happened on Tuesday, January 13th at about 4:23 p.m., so after regular school hours. In a letter to the school community, Garcia said a teacher was attacked and sustained stab wounds and that staff immediately called 911 and placed the building on lockdown. Billings Police Chief Rich St. John told local media that the stabbing occurred on the third floor following an altercation between the teacher and an 18-year-old female student. Police said the teacher's injuries were not life-threatening, and they also confirmed that the student suffered stab wounds as well, so both were taken to a hospital for treatment. Now, one detail that kept coming up in my earlier coverage of this case on Facebook, if you're not following me already, go to Facebook, True Crime Kelly, that's my page. I post a lot every day there. So I posted this story there, and I had a lot of people commenting about this student. So here is what I learned. St. John said that there were some events happening, including a concert and a wrestling match, which brought more people into the building than you would normally see at 4:23 on a Tuesday. So one of the wrestling coaches, Wade Austin, described being inside the building when the lockdown started and said nobody in the gym initially knew that somebody had been hurt. He told the news that it was like business as usual in the gym with athletes getting ready to compete until somebody ran in and told them that they were on lockdown. And at first they didn't even know why. Well, it turns out Jason Rader, a math teacher at Billings Senior High School, was stabbed in the left collarbone during a violent altercation. And the stabbing, like I said, took place on the third floor of the building following an altercation between this student and the teacher. So the student, there's been a lot of speculation about this student. Her name is Kaylee. She was, in fact, a lot of people have pointed this out, which is the only reason I'm mentioning it. But Kaylee was born a biological male. She was born Logan Wallace Lear and then changed their name to Kaylee Logan Lear and started presenting as a girl. So just for some context, last year, Kaylee reportedly OD'd in someone's front yard after she fell in love with this boy who did not reciprocate her feelings. And so I only share this part because I feel like it adds some context to the current situation if this person might have issues with rejection. Her social media posts are mostly her sharing outfits, although in one video, she, you know, talks about her rich girl Christmas haul. And it seems to be like this satirical video of her saying like, my parents are so cheap. All they got me was like Versace makeup and bags and like Chanel, this and that. And so I think it's supposed to be satire, but regardless, it's definitely odd. Now she also reposted a ton of stuff on her social media profiles, like on Discord and on TikTok and whatever other account she had. But the gist of these reposts were about being in love with your teacher and relationships between teachers and students and how she could relate to that and this and that. Now, the teacher is a married man with children, and there has been absolutely nothing to suggest that he acted inappropriately with Kaylee. It seems like this was maybe a one-sided situation, but obviously this is a fluid thing. It could certainly change as more details come out, if they do. But ultimately, Kaylee went to the classroom on the third floor that day where this teacher was, stabbed him, and then ran to the locker room where she proceeded to stab herself in the stomach and in the throat. Both of them survived and are in stable condition. The teacher was actually released from the hospital the next day. But I just want to make it very clear that there is no evidence to support that this teacher acted inappropriately with this student. I know we cover a lot of stories where that is the case, but in this case, it actually doesn't seem to be the case. Many people online have also found it odd that she seems to have a very deep fascination with Jodi Arias and Sharon Tate. So Jodi Arias, if you remember, I've covered her story on the podcast before, but she murdered her boyfriend Travis Alexander after he no longer wanted to be with her. So obviously couldn't handle rejection well in that story either. And Sharon Tate is kind of an odd liar because Sharon Tate was killed by the Charles Manson group and, you know, was stabbed to death. And so maybe the correlation there has to do with stabbing. I don't really know. In my humble and ignorant opinion, because I don't have all the facts of this case yet, this appears to be the result of an unhealthy, one-sided obsession that ultimately turned deadly. Thankfully, nobody did die, but when you attack somebody by stabbing them, you know, especially in the collarbone, which is very close to your, you know, aorta and like those important veins in your neck, it seems like the goal there is to maybe hit one of those. So I'll keep an eye on this case and update you in future weekly dockets if you're interested, and we'll see what happens. That is it for this week's weekly docket. Thank you for sticking with me through the whole thing. I know that was a lot of stories to cover. There was just a busy week in true crime this week, man. But if you ever have a story you want me to cover on a weekly docket, you can send me the link. You can tag me on social media. I'm TrueCrimeKelly1 on Instagram, or you can look me up on Facebook, True Crime Kelly. You can also go to my website, mamamystery.com, and send me a message there. Until next week, I'll have a deep dive for you, hopefully another Mama Minute episode. Send me those icks. And if you've made it this far, thank you so much. And please share this episode with someone you know who loves true crime as much as you do. Until then, I'll see you next week. Stay safe, stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that, cools up to 8 times faster, and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus an extra $100 off all mattresses. End Saturday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.